It started today. Wow. And a voice spoke. That's right. We're in Daniel chapter 10, which is what we'll be working our way through today. I had a couple of people ask me if I was done with chapter 9. And the answer is, I don't know if I am or not, but we're not going back to it today. We've talked enough about that. Let's move on with something else. So this is kind of the next main segment of Daniel. As I've been saying all along, the book of Daniel is pretty well divided as far as chapter divisions go. You know, your classic preacher complaint is bad chapter division, and Daniel really doesn't have that. You could quibble with this last bit because really what you have here is a single unit of thought from Daniel 10 all the way to the end. So this could be conceivably one chapter of material. The problem is it would be a really, really, really long chapter, which would probably need to be subdivided somehow. And so the way it's divided with chapter 10 and into the beginning of chapter 11 basically being the introduction to the vision, chapter 11 into the beginning of chapter 12 being the bulk of the vision itself, and then the end of chapter 12 being these final instructions to Daniel. Again, obviously, you could see that I wouldn't put it exactly where they do, but as far as dividing up a very long segment into three smaller segments, it's reasonable, I guess, to do it that way. So we are, from here until the end, really going to be in the same unit of thought. Unlike the rest of the book, which has kind of been chapter by chapter as its own little thing. And so we'll be working our way through this, and this is going to get us back into the details of the Maccabean time is really what we're going to get to as we get to chapter 11. But first, in chapter 10, there will be kind of the vision before the vision, I guess you might call it, and some things that kind of lead up and into that. So that's what we're going to be talking about today. Let's begin with a word of prayer, though. Our Father, we're thankful to you that you have revealed yourself to us in such a way that gives us confidence that the world that we live in is under your control, and that however things may appear, we know that you will be victorious. And so, Father, we ask that we would trust in you no matter how things may seem, and that we would live lives that seek to glorify you and honor you, that we would not fall prey to the lies of this world, that we would not believe in things that are transient, but that we would put our trust in the unseen, which is eternal. Help us now in our study to grow further in your word, to trust you even more. In your Son we pray. Amen. All right, so here's kind of where we're going. Let's begin. I'm gonna start by reading a little bit of the chapter. I don't really have a good feeling for how far I want to read, so I'll read for a while, and at some point I'll stop. And then we'll start to talk about some of these things. So Daniel chapter 10, beginning in verse 1. In the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, a word was revealed to Daniel, who was named Belteshazzar. And the word was true, and it was a great conflict, and he understood the word and had an understanding of the vision. In those days, I, Daniel, was mourning for 3 weeks. I ate no delicacies, no meat or wine entered my mouth, nor did I anoint myself at all for the full 3 weeks. On the 24th day of the first month, as I was standing on the bank of the great river, that is the Tigris, I lifted up my eyes and looked, and behold, a man clothed in linen with a belt of fine gold from Uphaz was around his waist. His body was like beryl, his face like the appearance of lightning, his eyes like flaming torches, his arms and legs like the gleam of burnished bronze, and the sound of his words like the sound of a multitude. And I, Daniel, alone saw the vision, for the men who were with me did not see the vision, but a great trembling fell upon them, and they fled to hide themselves. So I was left alone and saw this great vision, and no strength was left in me. My radiant appearance was fearfully changed, and I retained no strength. Then I heard the sound of his words, and as I heard the sound of his words, I fell on my face in a deep sleep with my face to the ground. And behold, a hand touched me and set me trembling on my hands and knees. And he said to me, O Daniel, man greatly loved, understand the words that I speak to you and stand upright, for now I have been sent to you. And when he had spoken this word to me, I stood up trembling. And he said to me, fear not, Daniel, for from the first day you set your heart to understand and humbled yourself before God, your words have been heard, and I have come because of your words. the prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me 21 days. But Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me, for I was left there with the kings of Persia, and came to make you understand what is to happen to your people in the latter days, for the vision is for days yet to come. When he had spoken to me according to these words, I turned my face toward the ground and was mute. And behold, one in the likeness of the children of man touched my lips. Then I opened my mouth and spoke. I said to him who stood before me, O my Lord, by reason of the vision, pains have come upon me, and I retain no strength. How can my Lord's servant talk with my Lord? For now no strength remains in me, and no breath is left in me. Again, one having the appearance of a man touched me and strengthened me, and he said, O man greatly loved, fear not, peace be with you, be strong and of good courage. And as he spoke to me, I was strengthened and said, Let my Lord speak, for you have strengthened me. Then he said, Do you know why I have come to you? But now I will return to fight against the prince of Persia, and when I go out, behold, the prince of Greece will come. But I will tell you what is inscribed in the book of truth. There is none who contends by my side against these except Michael, your prince. And as for me, in the first year of Darius the Mede, I stood up to confirm and strengthen him. And then the vision will really begin in verse 2 as to what he will see and what the information is going to be. So I guess I decided that I was going to just read the whole chapter. So let me start by saying, anything initially strike you as interesting or something that you're looking forward to hearing more about or you think is important or what just jumps out at you as we read through it? We may or may not talk about it a lot right now, but hopefully we'll get through these things. Yeah.
Whoever this terrifying vision is of, whoever this is, it seems to have struck him a lot more than when Gabriel showed up.
Yeah.
Last chapter, it seems a little bit more than even the angelic messengers that have been sent to.
Yeah, so one of the things we've talked about is, you know, how these visions are not easy experiences for Daniel. And there does seem to be maybe, at least it's spelled out in more detail, whether it is a stronger reaction or we just get more of the detail of it. I mean, we can't really know that, but it certainly is emphasizing that again, that it's not an easy experience to receive a vision from God. He falls on his face and he can't get up and he doesn't even have enough strength to talk. I don't know about you guys. You've had various illnesses that just leave you completely exhausted. I mean, when I had COVID, I had that experience. I would lay on the couch basically all day long, and I'd get up and go get a drink of water and come back and need to take a nap because I, you know, walked 100 feet. I mean, but even then I could talk. I wasn't that out of energy. I mean, not everyone in my house was happy I could still talk, but I could. You know, be that as it may, here is Daniel who needs, you know, heavenly strength in order to form a sentence. At this point. So this is definitely a rough experience for him. I'll have something more to say about that later on, yeah. What else? Anything else just kind of jump out at you? Yeah, Colleen?
I guess I don't think I realized this was all the same thing because in verse 1 it says it's the third year of Cyrus and then in verse 1 of 11 it says it's the first year of
Darius the Mede. Yeah, that is an interesting little contrast there. Some of that has to do with different ways of counting the reign of the kings. Some of it has to do with who this Darius the Mede is, which is its own question. Maybe I'll come back to that next week, dig a little bit more on that. So that's a good thought, is there is the two different time marks of these two different people, and how do we reconcile that? And that's something good to think about. Joy?
The part about how Daniel said he's the only one that saw the vision, those who were with him did not see it.
Sounds familiar, doesn't it?
Yeah. But such terror comes over them that they flee. If you don't see it, what were they scared of? Could they hear it? Maybe hear it?
Yeah. But doesn't that remind you of another scene in the Bible? The people that are with them that have some kind of experience, but not the same experience. See, Paul on the road to Damascus, right? where even the two different tellings of that kind of emphasize different aspects of it. One where they don't see the person, the other where they do see the light. One where they don't understand the speaker, but the other where they hear a sound. And so there's definitely the different experience between Paul and his companions, and the same thing is kind of going on here. That's an interesting comparison. Tom, were you going to say something?
Well, it's the idea that angels seem to be involved somewhat in the affairs of rise and fall of governments.
Yeah, so something we'll come back to is this prince of Persia and the prince of Greece, and Michael, one of the chief princes. We'll come back to that idea, and they do seem to be angelic figures. I think that's the best way of interpreting those, and that they are directly involved with specific nations and have something to do with the rise and the fall and the strength of these nations is an interesting thing. We'll come back to that. Jonathan?
The 21 days, it's another one of those weird time periods that pops up in this thing.
Yeah, the mourning and fasting for 3 weeks, and he was withstood for 21 days. It was on the 24th day of the first month. Anyone know what's important about the first month in the Jewish calendar? Those of you in my Esther class know the answer to this already, right? It's Passover, right? So Passover is the first month. If it's the 24th day and he's been fasting for 21, that means Daniel fasted straight through Passover, which is a really interesting thing because that's not a common thing to skip. It's one of the most important days of the year for the Jews, and here's Daniel skipping it to continue his fast. So that says either, Daniel's not that religious, which doesn't seem to be a very good option, or this is something that's really important, that if it's going to, if his fast is going to supersede Passover, that's an interesting thing. But yeah, the 21 days in particular that the prince of Persia withstood this man clothed in linen, as he is called, I don't know if there's something particular that's important symbolic about that. It is one of those, multiples of seven, and so there may be something symbolic there, but I don't know specifically what the meaning would be. Yeah, Andrew?
A real quick thing on top of that that also struck me was that, because I believe it says he was doing this for 3 weeks, that implies that this messenger was trying to come to him immediately again.
Yes.
And the moment that Daniel had started this again, this messenger had been sent out, though it had been delayed this time.
Right, and that's, so Daniel's fast for 3 weeks, and the 24th day he sees the vision, and the man tells him, 21 days I was withstood, and then in verse 13 it says specifically what, or verse 12, it says specifically what you're saying there. Fear not, Daniel, for from the first day that you set your heart to understand and humbled yourself before God, your words were heard, and I've come because of your words. But the prince of Persia withstood me for 21 days. And we'll come to that idea. It was an interesting thing by itself as well. Then the other thing that I was going to just kind of touch on briefly before we kind of come back and try to work through this more methodically. Did you notice that Daniel is, I think it's just twice, referred to as man greatly loved? That kind of stood out to me in reading it through. And I don't know, it's maybe a reflection of how soft and easy we've had it in American culture for all of our lives. But my first thought is, wow, if this is what you do to someone you love, you think of the experiences Daniel's had from being a teenager and ripped out of his homeland and taken to this place where they try to reprogram him basically at every single level, and multiple times where his life is in danger, lives an entire life of righteousness and doing what God wants him to do, only to find himself in his 80s and chucked into a lion's den. And then he has vision after vision after vision that just leaves him near dead at the end of it. If this is what you do to someone you love, it's kind of the old with friends like these sort of cliche. But again, I think that's more of a reflection of an easy American life where everything's, great and rosy all the time, and not realizing that, the life of a believer is not promised ever to be a charmed life, going down the easy street all the days of your life or anything like that. Here is a man who twice God says, you are greatly loved. And he's had a pretty rough go of it. But that doesn't mean that he's not greatly loved. And so the people who say, well, if God really loves me, why are bad things happening to me? you kind of have to contend with this perspective, with this message to Daniel at some point. Elaine?
I'm super impressed by Daniel, but I don't feel like I could be Daniel. And so that makes me then think, well, can I be greatly loved? But as I thought through that, as I've been sitting here the whole time, I actually worked through it already and realized God has already showed me that I'm greatly loved,
right,
despite the fact that I am not.
And we don't have to be either. I mean, we're not everyone is called to do what Daniel was called to do. But, of course, Jesus did die for anyone anyway. And that kind of goes back to the idea of, you know, the parable of talents. Not everyone's given 5 talents. Not everyone's given 4 talents. And all you can do is use what the Lord has given you, where he has put you, to serve him as the best you can. Joy. Highly esteemed. I didn't look it up either. Tom, what's the word there? Did you look it up? Takes delight.
I have an easier time with Daniel being highly esteemed. You know.
Yeah.
I suppose you could distinguish between, you know, you love all your kids even when they're, you know, rotten. There's no question about you loving them, but you're not delighting in their hooliganism or whatever they're up to.
I didn't expect that we'd be using the word hooliganism in class today. Well, chapter 6, maybe. You've got those guys conspiring against Daniel.
Just to make clear, I'm not speaking from personal experience.
Well, I mean, other than Andrew. All right. Well, let's kind of work our way through this text in a little bit more detail. I think one thing that's worth noting is as we get into this is the setting of this vision. The first wave of Jews have returned to Palestine by the 3rd year of the reign of Cyrus. Daniel did not. That's an interesting thing. I don't know if you've ever picked up on that before. By this point, all those who were going back went back. Daniel was not among them. Presumably that's because he is in this very high position in the Persian government, and he is continuing to stay behind and use his authority and his position to help his brethren as he has the opportunity to. A really interesting thing about this is, as we think about that, is this sudden throwback to Daniel, who was named Belteshazzar. That was his Babylonian name. That was given to him by Nebuchadnezzar, and it shows up when the Babylonians are talking directly to him most frequently, about him is where it shows up. And so all of a sudden, this Babylonian name shows up again, and you can't help but wonder if and what the significance of that is. And I don't know the answer to that myself, but it really kind of just jumps out at me. Here we are in the Persian period, 3 years into the Persian period, and his Babylonian name shows up again. So if y'all figure out the answer to that between now and next week, let me know. But if you compare this with the account in Ezra, just to kind of get the historical context, at this point the altar has been rebuilt, but they've run into opposition. And it's not going to take long before they stop working on the temple. And that work is going to stop for some 15 years. I don't know exactly, you know, off the top of my head, how to pin this exactly down the timeline, but that's roughly what's going on, is the people have gone home. This is great news. I mean, Daniel's prayed his prayer in chapter 9. God has said, you're going home. They have gone home, but now they're hitting some roadblocks. And that may well be part of what's going on. You know, Daniel has received this vision in the last chapter, and he has confidence that the exiles are all going to be going home, and they are. And now, now we're running into some obstacles again. And so Daniel seeks to pray. He seeks to understand, in particular, is what the man clothed in linen is going to say to him. From the first day you set your heart to understand and humbled yourself before God, I came with an answer. And so what is he trying to understand? Maybe an important question to think about here as he is beginning this process of supplication, where he is mourning and fasting for these 3 weeks, which is going to you know, ultimately lead to the 24th day of the first month is when all of this then begins to happen. You know, maybe it's connected back to the difficulties that are going on in Jerusalem. He's identifying with them and their struggles. Maybe it takes us back to him seeking, you know, further insight into what's going on. You remember chapter 8 and verse 27, he says, "I was appalled by the vision and I did not understand it." He has the vision in chapter 9, and I mean, who on earth understands that? And so maybe part of what he's going through here is, well, I thought our people were going home and everything was going to be great, and that's not what's happening. And God has given me this insight into the future that I don't fully understand, and so I'm seeking to better understand the information that God has shown me. Maybe there are answers to what's happening back home as it relates to some of these visions I've already received. Well, whatever the case is, his seeking a further insight is what's ultimately going to lead to God sending him more information in this vision here in chapter 11. And as we think about this fast, this is an interesting thing as well. I eat no delicacies, no meat or wine enter my mouth, nor did I anoint myself at all for the full 3 weeks. What is that implying about what he normally does? That he would eat delicacies, right? He would partake of these things. The fact that he doesn't do it for 3 weeks as part of this morning and fasting suggests that he does otherwise. And the significance of that is when you go all the way back to chapter 1 and you say, why doesn't Daniel eat this food and drink this wine and partake of these delicacies? Well, the answer is not that it's inherently sinful unless he's sinning right now. So, I mean, that is a whole issue for itself back in chapter 1 as to what exactly the motivation is for that. But as you wrestle with that in chapter 1, remember this in chapter 10, this gives us at least a little bit of insight into what's not going on with that food in chapter 1. There's nothing inherently evil about it, or I don't know, maybe Daniel has grown and changed his perspective on it. He thought it was sinful in chapter 1, and now as an older man, he realizes there's nothing wrong with it. It could be something like that, I suppose, as well. Whatever the case may be, he is giving up these things as he seeks to better understand, and God will send this message. As I said already, he fasts through Passover up until the middle of near the end of the first month. Passover is in the middle of the first month, which speaks to the seriousness of his commitment to mourn and to seek for this understanding as to what's going on. And so God then sends this response to him. Who is this man clothed in linen? And the response is that, but it's also the question, I guess, if you repunctuate that. Who is this man clothed in linen? And people have answered this a variety of different ways. I mean, when Andrew brought him up a minute ago, what do you say, whoever he is, this person, whoever he is, it seems to be different from Gabriel. And so, who is this guy? Well, I think there are some things that we can rule out, although they are common suggestions. Two are, some see this as a vision of God himself, and some see it as pre-incarnate Christ. And some of that's based on other passages. I mean, the experience with the companions of Daniel is like the experience of the companions of Paul when Jesus meets them after the resurrection. So you can make that kind of connection. The problem with both of those views is the thought that this Prince of Persia character would withstand God until Michael came and bailed him out. I got a problem with that view, you see? It needs to be the other way around. He withstands an angel until God bails him out, or withstands an angel until another angel bails him out, or something along those lines. And that's ultimately, the perspective here. I think it's clear this is a spiritual being, but any being that is some manifestation of God is not going to be withstood by somebody unless God wants them to be. And that doesn't seem to be the case here. It seems to be that I was trying to get you this information and I got stopped. And I was stuck there until Michael showed up. And so this does not seem to be any manifestation of God, but a lower spiritual being of some kind. And so some have suggested that it is Gabriel again, but for some reason his name is not given. Or perhaps some other angel as well. One author specified that he thinks it's a cherub, which is weirdly specific to me. I think the connection that he's making is with the an Ezekiel vision and someone in linen and the cherubim being around and all of that, but I don't know that we can draw that clear of a line. The bottom line is we don't really know exactly who it is, but it's probably an angelic being. That's what makes the best sense of what we have. I mean, even the idea, he says, I was sent, right? Well, again, who sent him with this information? And that, again, that kind of rules out God being one of the options, is because this one was sent. So he's not named. It's best not to get too specific. He's not described as to what type of spiritual being he is, so it's probably best not to get too specific, except that I think it's safe to say that it's not Michael, you know, law of non-contradiction and all. Michael was saved by Michael. I guess there could be two angels named Michael, but, you know, other than that... other than that, it's just best not to be too specific. As we talked about, the speed of the response is an important piece of this as well. Daniel was praying. This is an answer to this prayer. From the very beginning of all of this, God sent an answer. And this guy was tied up with other business for a while, which brings us then to this issue, right? He's struggling with the prince of Persia. Who on earth is the prince of Persia? Well, if Cyrus is the king, that would mean his son Cambyses is the prince of Persia, right? Cambyses, he's out there fighting with an angel and stopping him for a while. Well, no, I don't think that's the point either. Especially when, again, you get to Michael, one of the chief princes. So you know this Michael is characterized as a prince as well. And when you get to chapter 12 and verse 1... we again encounter Michael, who is the great prince who has charge of your people. And so Michael is the prince of Israel, you might say, in that context. So we have the prince of Persia, we have the prince of Israel, Michael, and then he says in verse 20, I'm going to return to fight against the prince of Persia, and when I go out, behold, the prince of Greece will come. And so there's another one. And if this person is a spiritual being of some kind, which I think is the best way to read it, then it's safe to understand it as only another spiritual being could withstand this spiritual being. And if Michael is the same Michael that we know in the Bible, otherwise is Michael the archangel, again, it would make sense that he could come and assist this angel. It would make sense for him to be the prince of Israel in that context. What it all points to is what Tom was saying a few minutes ago, that there are spiritual and angelic forces behind nations. You get to the book of Revelation, and you know the nation of Rome is powered by Satan himself in the book of Revelation. And so, if Satan is behind Rome, the prince of Persia can be an evil spiritual force. The prince of Greece can be an evil spiritual force. The prince of Israel is Michael the archangel, who is some sense. Of spiritual force behind them. And so, you know, what it all boils down to is there are spiritual forces behind physical things. And Daniel does not give us enough information for us to know all the details of how that works. What are the mechanics of this? We don't know. Daniel doesn't tell us. And I don't think the point of this is also that now we have something new to fret about. That there are spiritual forces out there. I mean, here's a spiritual force behind an evil nation that is strong enough to withstand one of God's angels for 3 weeks. What are we going to do now? That's not the point either. The point isn't for us to worry about them or for us to try to do war with them ourselves or anything like that. The point is for us to know of them and to ultimately leave their defeat to God. It's a reminder that nations are beastly things, as we said back in chapter 7. Because, you know, Michael was the prince of Israel, we make a bad equation if we then turn around and say, well, he must also be the angel of America. No, I don't think that's the case. I think probably if there's an angel of America, a prince of America, it's going to be more like the prince of Persia in Greece. And Michael would be the prince of God's kingdom now, if it's still the same sort of situation that, you know, was going on back then, and I hesitate to extrapolate that every kingdom for every time of history and all of that, there is some spiritual force behind them exactly, you know. Again, we don't understand the mechanics of all of this, but the point is to know that there are spiritual realities behind the physical realities. And ultimately, that above and beyond all of it is the creator of everything, including the spiritual realities, who has charge over all things, and that he will one day be victorious. What it means then on this level as well, when it says the Most High rules in the kingdoms of man and gives it to whom he wills, you remember that theme that we've seen so much? Well, that's not just the physical kingdoms. That's these principalities as well, as the New Testament refers to it. The Most High rules in the kingdoms of men. The Most High raises up kings and throws down kingdoms and all of that that we've seen. Well, it's on the spiritual level too, not just on the physical level. And so that theme shows up here in a very different kind of way. Andrew, were you going to say something a second ago?
No, I think you're
interested. Okay. Dare I ask if there's comments on the Prince of Persia? Yeah, Noah.
I think step back from the Prince of Persia.
Oh, good. Both of the chapter numbers have a one in them. Is that so? No, I think they're. Yeah, we are coming to the end of the book, and if I'm right that 10 through 12 is the final vision, that's all kind of a unit. It then does kind of give you this book ending of the entire book of Daniel by reminding us of these things, and maybe part of it is to make us think of just how far things have gone. You start with Daniel as the child. Who is standing up in the king's court. Now you've got Daniel, the faithful old man, who's receiving, you know, revelation after revelation after revelation from God. And from the beginning of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, from the beginning of the Babylonian Empire, all the way through the Babylonian Empire until the beginning of the Persian Empire, and then as we will see, the Prince of Greece will come, and then chapter 11 is all going to be all about Alexander and the Seleucids and Ptolemies after that. That this reign of God is continuing on. And, you know, the book of Daniel is not going to give us every bit of history from that point forward forever. But when you see that all the way through the Babylonian period, all the way through the Persian period, and all the way through the Greek period, God is in control of all of it, that should give you confidence that God will continue to remain in control. And it may be a way of bringing that theme back around to say, and it doesn't stop now. It's just going to keep on going.
And is it from the deportation from the get-go to kind of going back to, did you say that the third year of Cyrus was then returning back?
Yeah, they returned pretty early on. They would be back by now. I need to double-check in Ezra to get the exact timeline. But most of the first wave, I mean, they kind of return in waves like they were taken away in waves. But most of the first wave is back home by now, and they've started working on things. Martha?
Does it say specifically that he was fasting somewhere else, or just that he was not eating delicacies?
Yeah, so that's another question. I kind of skipped by that, and that is, you know, is he fasting, or is... is he just giving up these delicacies in particular? Yeah. What? Yeah, so there you go. So yeah, if he's...
It wouldn't mean he was not doing the Passover, he just wasn't doing these...
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah. And so yeah, that is a good question, and especially when you tie it back to chapter 1, that may be a good clue as to what's going on there. When he says, I'm not eating any delicacies... I was mourning for 3 weeks. I'm not eating delicacies. Is the presumption then that he's mourning and fasting because those two things go together? Or is it mourning and just putting away all of the fancy stuff and going back to the kind of bare essentials like he was in chapter 1? And that would then answer the question about Passover as well. So yeah, that's a good thought. Thank you. All right, well, what happens next, of course, is that he is strengthened by the angel. And Daniel's reactions, verse 8, no strength was left in me. My radiant appearance was fearfully changed, and I retained no strength. I heard the sound of his words, and as I heard the sound of his words, I fell on my face in a deep sleep with my face to the ground. Verse 11, when he spoke in this word to me, I stood up trembling. Verse 15, I turned my face toward the ground and was mute. Verse 17, how can my Lord's servant speak with my Lord? For now there no strength remains in me, and no breath is left in me. I mean, it's pretty serious all the way through this chapter. But then in verses 10 and 11, behold, a hand touched me and set me trembling on my hands and knees. And he said, O Daniel, man greatly loved, understand the words that I now speak to you and stand upright, for I have been sent to you. Verse 12, fear not, Daniel, for from the first day that you set your heart to understand, your words have been heard. Verse 16, one of the likenesses of the children of men touched my lips, and I opened my mouth and spoke. I said to him who stood before me, and he goes on and talks there. Verse 18, one having the appearance of a man touched me and strengthened me, and he said, O man greatly loved, fear not, peace be with you, be strong and of good courage. And as he spoke to me, I was strengthened and said, let my Lord speak, for you have strengthened me. And so there's this constant back and forth through the entire part of this vision where Daniel is just, you know, pummeled in some sense. All of his strength is taken away, and then he's strengthened. And then it's all gone, and then he's strengthened, and then it's all gone, and then he's strengthened, and it's just this back and forth through the whole thing. And there are two things that I think about as I think about that particular interplay here. One is to try to appreciate what these men went through so we can have God's revelation today. You know, we're much more likely to say, man, it sure would have been cool to have seen God. And I'm sure there would have been something cool about it, but that's not what Daniel is thinking at this point. Man, this is sure a cool experience. This is like, I think I'm dead. I don't think there's any life in me at all. And, you know, earlier? He was appalled for days, did not understand it. I lay sick for some days and was overcome. I mean, all the way through Daniel 7 through 12, anytime there's any comment on how the vision Daniel received affected him, it was not good for Daniel. He was exhausted, he was sick, he was flat on his face and unable to move. He needed strength given to him just to utter some words. He has no breath left in him. I mean, it is constant. And I don't know if that's what every experience for every single person was like, but I will say that more often than not, when someone has some sort of divine visitation, they are terrified. They're not sitting there going, oh, wow, this is super neat. You know, that's not what's going on. Which brings me then to, you know, claims of receiving revelation today that you hear from people from time to time. Let me read you a quote I came across that I think is pretty fantastic. He's going to make reference to a fellow named John MacArthur. If you don't know him, he's an evangelical pastor of some sort. This author said, a man once waited to speak with John MacArthur after a meeting somewhere. He told him how often he saw the Lord, had visions of him, and that Jesus talked with him often. As an example, the man said, he'll come and speak to me while I'm shaving. John MacArthur's response was, I have just one question. Do you stop shaving? The near flippancy is so unlike what we meet in the Bible. In the Bible, one doesn't chat with the Almighty. Even when one of the Lord's angelic servants brings the revelation, that experience is not just the neatest thing, but devastating anguish. And that's an interesting thing to consider when someone says, yeah, God spoke to me. You know, God told me this. Yeah, what was that like? Did it stop you from doing what you were doing? Because if it didn't, you probably weren't talking to God. That's just, I don't know, to me that's one of those things that it's kind of in the background of Daniel. It's not the main point of anything that's going on, but it's informative when you are talking with people that speak that way about their relationship with God. Jonathan? Yeah.
There were occasions where he was terrified, like the Transfiguration.
Right.
That was an exception, not the norm.
And what I would say, though, and anyone that didn't hear the question, is, you know, what was that, how does that relate to Jesus? Because people weren't terrified of him, with perhaps the exception being the Transfiguration. And what I'd say is that the Transfiguration is as close as anyone got to seeing Jesus in the glory of Jesus. And the rest of the time, we saw Jesus as a human rather than Jesus as a glorified being. And there's a difference, too, in angelic figures. I mean, Lot had a couple of angels at his house for a while, and he wasn't, you know, falling on his face in terror then because they appeared as men. And those same two angels and God appearing as a man showed up and talked to Abraham before that. And so there are two ways that spiritual beings show up. One is as a person where they may not want you to know they're a spiritual being, in which case you don't have that kind of reaction. And the other is when they show up as a spiritual being and you want to worship that spiritual being and they say, stop it, I'm not God. And those are kind of the two basic angelic appearances that you find in the Bible. And what Daniel is experiencing is the latter. What Jesus was in the flesh is more of the former, but an even greater condescension than an angel in human guise. So, Martha?
And Jesus came to draw all men to him. It was a bringing about, not stand over there and look.
Right, and you think about that even. You contrast Jesus, who people, you know, came to willingly, and God on Mount Sinai, who the people said, Moses, you go talk to him. I'm terrified. And again, it's that same sort of contrast between Jesus in the flesh and God in his glory. Again, to some extent, they didn't see God in his full glory on Mount Sinai, but enough of it to terrify them. All right, well, let's wrap this up then. Verses 20 and 21 is kind of the summation of all of this. So, you know, I've come to bring you this message, but for now, there's more fighting with Persia for me to do. That's an interesting thing, too, by itself, because the way that I think we're inclined to think about Persia is they're kind of the good guys. You know, Assyria, they were just nasty evil. Babylon, they're the ones that destroyed the temple and carried them into captivity. Greece, that's going to lead to the Seleucids and all the awful things that Antiochus Epiphanes did. Persia, they're the good guys in the middle. Cyrus is the one who was named by God to send the captives back and rebuild the city and rebuild the temple. Yeah, Persia, they're the good guys. Except that God's angel is fighting with their angel, so obviously they're not the good guys. Their angel is trying to withstand God's angel from delivering a message to God's prophet. They're not the good guys. So just because a nation does some good stuff along the way doesn't mean that it's a good nation at the most basic ground level. There has only been one nation ever that is God's nation, and that is Israel, whether it's physical Israel in the Old Testament or spiritual Israel in the New Testament. That is the only God's nation that there is or ever has been or ever will be. And we do ourselves well to remind us of that as we go through our lives in a country that sometimes deludes itself into thinking that it's God's nation, that it's a Christian nation or whatever else it might be. It's a wonderful nation in a variety of ways. But we need to keep that in the right sort of perspective. So for now, there's more fighting to do with Persia. After that, there's more fighting that's going to be done with Greece. And however bad things might seem right now, it's going to get even worse than that in the future. And that's what chapter 11 is going to bring to us in detail. But understand that God is still in control. Michael is contending by my side. Your prince, Michael, is contending by my side. And we know that this Michael is enough to overthrow the prince of Persia based on that earlier encounter. So again, in spite of present appearances, God is in control. The Most High is the one who reigns in the kingdoms of men. And then as we get into chapter 11, we're going to start to get the details of what is coming in this Greek period. All right, last thoughts or comments here? Yeah, Dan?
A couple of things. So Moses said that God would send them a prophet like himself, mm-hmm. and that they are to listen to him. This is right after the people appealed to Moses, say, we don't want God to talk to us anymore because we're going to die if he does.
Yeah.
And then it seems to me that God has given man a particularly unique position to participate in this spiritual warfare, which Daniel showed by his prayer. His prayer, we can pray to God to affect the spiritual warfare.
Yeah. That is something that I think is pretty clear in Ephesians 6 as well. That prayer is the way we do spiritual battle. I mean, we're familiar with the whole armor of God, right? You've heard that since you were a kid in Sunday school class. You probably had the picture of the soldier and you colored the various pieces of armor and all that. But the way that all ends is not take the helmet of salvation, the sword of the Spirit, and go fight the battle. It's take the helmet of salvation and the sword of the Spirit, which is the Word of God, praying at all times in the Spirit with all prayer and supplication. To that end, keep alert with all perseverance, making supplication for all the saints. Pray with all prayer and all supplication and all perseverance for all the saints. And that's the way you wage spiritual battle, is on your knees, which is a very different sort of thing from what we expect. And honestly, I mean, again, Paul says, pray at all times with all prayer and all perseverance for all the saints, and we're more inclined to pray at some times, with some perseverance for some of the saints. And we just got to make that adjustment and do more of the spiritual fighting the way that we should rather than the way we sometimes think that we should. So, thanks for that. Anything else? All right, well, next time we'll get into chapter 11, which is going to get us into a lot of nitty-gritty details of the intertestamental period. So I will try to remember to bring a handout with me that will help, I hope, with some of that in terms of understanding what's going on in the historical world and how Daniel 11 relates directly to that. This is some of the most specific historical prophecy that you find anywhere in the Bible as far as... without naming names, is basically naming names. It's, you know exactly who all of these people are and what's being talked about if you know the history. So it's interesting, but if you're not up on your intertestamental history very well, and most of us probably aren't just off the top of our heads, it may be a little bit tough. So I'll try to bring something to help out with that next week, and we'll get into chapter 11, and we'll see if we can get through it all in once or not. Thanks for your attention and comments.